This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt should say host, but also realtors with Oakwin Realty in downtown Vancouver. Super excited for today. We've got Nav Panu. He's a partner at DMCL focusing on Canadian tax. And Mohammed Shahid, he's the senior manager of the Canadian tax group at DMCL. Both of these guys really, really understand the Canadian tax system. And with a slant as well in kind of people with large portfolios, including real estate.
Yeah, this was strap in. This one gets deep. I feel like I'm going to listen back to this one 3, 4, 5 times, potentially 2 to 3 times a year.
Yeah.
Just to remind myself of all the tax tips, because we dig deep. And I feel like we don't start with, you know, usually, Adam, we structure the show where we go broad, then we dig deeper. I feel like this one, we get right into it. We go deep immediately, and there's so many takeaways. Pretty sophisticated conversation, I would say, but yeah, tons of takeaways.
A lot of people out there, when people start talking about tax, their eyes glaze over, myself included sometimes. These guys were fired up about tax and tax planning. So it was a really great conversation. I was on the edge of my seat the entire time. I think there's going to be a ton of takeaways for people that listen to this show, for sure.
Yeah. And just to be clear, they're very sophisticated.
Yes.
Not you or me.
Right. Exactly. Before we get to that, Matt, of course, we have the segment that remains nameless.
That's right. The second last show of the year, the segment that remains nameless. Here's one for you, Adam. So October to November, I think everybody was, you know, I don't know if anyone was all that excited to see the stats come out. I don't think anybody thought there would be anything all that exciting. But there was 2,737 MLS sales in the Vancouver region in November. Okay? So that was an 18% drop from October. Okay? So that number, 2,737 in the Vancouver region, was an 18% drop over October in terms of the number of sales. My question for you, Adam, is what is the typical drop? Because 18% drop, you're like, okay, but we're going into Christmas. Sales slow down in November and into December. But is an 18% drop typical? Well, Adam, I'll tell you it's not. But here's the question. What is a typical drop from October to
so
November?
What's a seasonal kind of percentage-wise? Oh, I've never thought about that. That's an interesting question.
And you know what? I will say, I mean, pump my own tires a little bit. I did come up with this question myself, but I want to shout out the gang over at Rennie because this is based on some of the stats they're producing and it's a great email list to sign up for. So shout out to those guys. Any guesses?
Well,
Before you get to your guess, Adam, let's talk about a couple of our listings. You know what? I feel like we're getting to that time of year where not a lot is happening. I did just want to point out, I think we talked about this listing a few weeks back, 410-4310 Hastings at Mosaic Building. I think the only boutique concrete building in all of Burnaby, I might be wrong about that, but right in the Heights, that listing over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, Adam, is under contract. The last week's listing that we talked about, 2503-1283 Howe Street. This is a 2-bed, 1-bath, 632 square feet at Tate on Howe, right next to the Beach District, Yale Town. Fantastic views, fantastic floor plan. Listed at $599. It just goes to show, Adam, when something is priced correctly, it garners attention, let's say.
Right.
This is, we've had an overwhelming response to 12, yes, or 2503 1283 Howe Street, not under contract yet. But next time I talk to you, it may very well be. If you want to see that or anything else, or jump on that hot property, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. While you're there, Adam, click sell with us, where you can download the sold plan, start on launch date, get your property ready for sale. The spring market's coming, and get it sold for top dollar. VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Sell with us.
Okay. Well, Matt, my guess is going to be, I'm going to say a 7% drop is what would be typical.
So we're more than double then.
Yes.
More than double. That's depressing, Adam, if it's correct. It is not correct. It's 9%. It is double. Exactly. So again, pretty close. I would say you're at about 81, 82% if I'm keeping score. You're up at 86. You're dropping. You just dropped a couple percentage points. You're going to finish off. Is that a B+? You might finish off the year at a B+. But we still have one more.
One of the best
week.
Grades I've ever gotten. All right, let's do it.
Speaking of grades, though, Nas and Mo, these guys are whip smart. This is a great conversation. And I feel like we had them in the studio. So it was old school and riveting stuff. Maybe we should just launch into our talk with these guys.
I can't wait. This is honestly, even if you're not an accounting person or a tax person, this one is really, it's a gripping conversation.
EMCL, great stuff. Enjoy.
Attention realtors, homebuyers, and investors. If you missed out on Atlin at Clayton Crest by Zentera Developments, here's your second chance.
Atlin sold 80% in just 3 months, Adam. And because of that success, Zentera is launching Building 2, Butte.
Located in West Clayton and walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, prices are still low for now, but not for long.
Homeowners across the Lower Mainland are using equity from their current homes to invest in West Clayton, ahead of the SkyTrain and the next market upswing, because when that SkyTrain is complete and the market rebounds, it'll be too late.
This, Matt, is how wealth is built. Find out why Atlin sold so fast and register now at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia.
Serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakland, please reach out to us at oakland.com/join and type into that message box, the rep. And you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Okay, so we're here with Mo Shahid. He is a senior manager in Canadian tax, and Nav Panu, he's the partner in Canadian tax, both from DMCL. Thanks so much for taking the time today, guys.
No problem.
Yeah, maybe for our listeners, can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself? Maybe Mo?
Sure, yeah. So like I said, we're from DMCL. I'm a senior tax manager. I've been back at DMCL for a few years. I also articled at DMCL and then I left for a little bit. And my experience has been mostly in Canadian tax, little bit in international tax as well. And now I primarily focus on, you know, a little bit of international tax, intergenerational wealth transfer that we're dealing with right now, and succession planning.
Right on. Just out of curiosity, intergenerational wealth transfer, we've talked a lot about that on the show. Is that a growing field?
It is, because, you know, our parents' age, they're sort of on that retirement phase. And there's a lot of businesses that are going through that phase right now. And so it's a big piece of what we do. And, you know, there's now new tax rules that we're exploring for clients that allow us to do this a little bit more tax efficiently, as in, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. So it's definitely a growing field.
Right on. Nice. And Nav?
Yeah, so I'm also in Canadian tax. I've been at it for about 11 years now. And I primarily work out of our Surrey office. I do very similar work to Mo. So I have a background in private enterprise. So I was mostly helping small to medium-sized businesses. And I really focus on mostly corporate reorganizations, estate planning. But again, now we're seeing a lot of other different types of transactions, seeing a lot of stock option planning. You know, a lot of people want to get their employees into their businesses. That's, you know, the current trend. So, you know, we see we probably touch everything, I'd say.
Yeah.
A little bit of everything at DMCL. Yeah.
And that's kind of the good thing about DMCL as well, is because we're a mid-size firm, but we've got clients and across all different industries.
Yeah.
Right on. So maybe as a starting point, you know, we have a lot of real estate investors that listen to the show. If somebody comes to you and they're just starting out on a course of potentially buying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 properties, like, what tax advice would you give to somebody? Kind of key considerations early days as a real estate investor.
I can take that one. So I think early on, if somebody comes to me and says potentially they want to grow a real estate empire, that might be different. But early on, I find, depending on where their capital is coming from, if it's just an individual or a husband, wife, we may suggest to them just to do it personally. And that advice may change. And again, if they continue to grow and they have more and more properties, we do have an option to tax defer that and put it into a corporation.
So starting out individual?
I would say so. Because there's that burden of, if it's in a corporation, you have to file with the CRA, you get scrutinized by the CRA, there's heavy incorporation costs, there's annual fees to upkeep, as well as you have to hire a firm to do the corporate tax returns. And so it can be kind of burdensome, especially if they don't plan on continuing that growth.
Right.
They may be better off just having it personally and having a bit more leeway. Again, another key point is that usually when people only have one property and they acquire another, oftentimes they move between them. I've seen a lot of times clients buy another property and they think, okay, well, let's go live in that one. Let's go rent out our old house. And then that arrangement all changes in a corporation too, because you get into personal use issues.
Yeah, right. Primary residence.
Exactly.
Owned by a corporation.
Exactly.
I just wanted to ask just one more thing to that is, I think one of the first things that you have to ask clients who are trying to build a real estate empire is, you know, what other sources of income do they have? Because I think that's really important. And Nav touched on this as well. Like, you know, yes, you could buy it personally, but if you already are kind of at like high level of income, then maybe after you buy a couple, then you could think about the tax deferred transaction that Nav's talking about and having it in the corporation. And you can sort of leave the cash and the income in the corporation. If you don't actually need the cash and you already are a high earner paying tax at the very top bracket.
So maybe just taking a step back for listeners that don't understand the benefits of having real estate in a corporation, or why you'd even incorporate in the first place. Can we get kind of down to like brass tacks? What is the benefit of having a corporation involved in the first place?
Yeah. The biggest benefit I see of a corporation is flexibility. Oftentimes when you buy a piece of land, that land title is registered to the individual. And anytime that land has to move between people, we have property transfer tax here in BC. And that gets triggered on every transfer. That changes when it's within a company and now you're dealing with shares. And shares can quite easily be manipulated. You can exchange them for other classes of shares. You can bring in new shareholders. You can introduce family trusts. What you can do with your wealth when you have it within a corporation, it becomes a lot more flexible. And so that, to me, I'd say is the biggest benefit of incorporating, is that you can have ultimate flexibility to introduce shareholders, make changes as you please.
So from a, say, a generational wealth kind of perspective, right?
Exactly.
You're trying to build something, you have a couple kids.
You want to pass it on to them?
Yeah. So
it's
when they're an adult, they buy into the holdco or whatever you have.
We could do like estate freezes.
Yeah.
Right. So if mom and dad or, you know, have built a company with 4 or 5 properties and it's worth whatever, $4 or $5 million, and they're thinking, you know, we want to pass this on to our kids. Like Nav touched on, with the corporation, it's so much more flexible, because what we do is called an estate freeze. So it freezes the value in the mom and dad's hands at the time they've sort of decided to pass on the wealth. And then the future growth of the properties can then just go to the new shareholders, which could be the kids. That way, what we've done is, like Nav alluded to earlier, is you haven't really paid additional property transfer tax,
right?
Because the title hasn't changed. The title of the properties is going to continue to stay in the corporation, versus if you held them personally and you wanted to pass them on, then now you would have change of title and potentially property transfer tax.
What about, so when you say estate freeze, am I wrong in thinking that I have a holding, a hold co with whatever assets in it?
Yeah.
I decide when I'm 75, I want to transfer this to my daughter. Can I not just sell her all the shares or transfer all the shares to her?
You could, but it would likely trigger a taxable event.
Okay.
And the big thing for us when we're estate planning is we're careful of your eventual passing. Because when you pass, whatever you own, there'll be a deemed disposition on your death. And so if you do have a real estate empire and it's worth tens of millions, for example, that's going to be deemed to be disposed of on your death. And a common misconception we get is people think to us, okay, we want to save tax. How do we not pay tax? The eventuality is you will pay tax. What we can offer most of the time is deferral. How far can you kick that can down the road?
Yeah.
And in the interim, use that tax that you're not paying to accumulate more wealth.
Right. What about people that own property individually or personally, and then as they're growing, they incorporate? Would they sell their personal properties to the corporation, or how does that work? Or is there a benefit of getting those initial, say, three properties that you own personally in the corporation?
Yeah, definitely can be. And that can be easily done. We do have a mechanism called a Section 85 transfer. And there's certain property that we can move to a corporation. And in consideration, the person that's transferring it will get shares, additional shares of that corporation. And so it can be done. And the benefit, I mean, it could be for a variety of reasons that are not tax related. It could be for financing reasons. When you have multiple corporations, maybe get easier to get lending down the road. And also people just like to kind of keep their stuff together as well sometimes. You may have a reason to leave it out. If, again, like I mentioned, if you're moving in and out of the property,
right,
does it really make sense to roll it into a corporation where there is a personal aspect to it?
And is there, like you said, tax deferral before, but is there any like day-to-day benefit? So long-term flexibility is one reason to incorporate. Can you talk a little bit about the different, how much you're paying in tax,
right,
on rental income, for instance?
That's a really good question. And that goes back to my earlier comment about, you know, finding out how much the individual makes.
Yeah.
So for example, right now the highest rate in BC is 53.5%. And in a corporation, if you're earning rental income, we call that, it's basically passive income. So at the highest possible rate, passive income is actually taxed at 50.7%. So there's approximately a 3% sort of, you know, savings of having all the rental income inside a corporation. I mean, it gets a little bit nuanced because part of that 50.7 can be refunded by the corporation if you actually pay a dividend out to the shareholders. But just ignoring all of that, if all you had was a person, you know, in the highest tax bracket making 53.5%, and if they decided to move all their rental properties inside a corporation and they don't actually need that cash, you can leave it inside a corporation and only pay tax at 50.7%. So day to day, like your question, you're getting a deferral of like 3%
mm-hmm.
tax savings on an annual basis.
Another key thing we see with corporations, at least in our world, is a lot of these individuals that are acquiring or want to build a real estate empire, they generally have a fund source coming from somewhere. And a lot of times they have other corporations.
Right.
And they're earning business income from another business.
Yeah, good point.
And that business, when we talk about, Mo referenced passive income, but active business income in Canada is only taxed at 11% for the first 500,000. And after that, it's taxed at 27%. So the rates are actually a lot lower. And so for somebody that owns a business and they're accumulating wealth at a corporate level, we can move those funds through a dividend, a tax-free dividend, to another real estate corporation that they also control and start investing in real estate.
So this is, just to be clear, a big one, right? Because if you have income, active business income in one corporation only taxed at 11%,
yep,
you never get hit with that personal tax.
Exactly.
If you're transferring it.
Correct.
For a down payment on another property.
And the key thing is you can transfer it to another corporation that you control tax-free.
What if I own the real estate personally? So say I have a rental property I own personally and I have business income in a corporation. Can I sell my personal real estate I'm thinking specifically of people out there that might have business income, might have a hold co in a...
I recommend that quite often because a lot of times when people build a lot of wealth in, at the corporate level, the question always becomes, how do I get it out to myself personally?
Yeah.
So if you have wealth personal that you can transfer into a corporation, it'll actually allow you then to extract some of that cash out as consideration for
through
the transfer.
Yeah. Yeah. The only thing I would be careful of is if you're going to be transferring, say, rental properties to a company that has active business income, we have these rules that basically, because like Nav mentioned, on the first 500,000, you only pay 11% tax. That's the BC rate right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but if you have passive income in that same corp or even an additional corp, after $50,000 of net passive income, the small business deduction actually starts to grind a little bit. Once you get to about $150,000 of passive income, you actually end up losing the small business rate. And then you're paying tax on the active business income, which is 27%. So you do have to be careful, you know, of where you're moving the properties and how we, you know, but if you're making good income and you've got your rental properties that are generating over $150,000 of passive income, I think you're going to be okay anyways.
Right.
Right. So there's, you don't want to look at just tax all the time. Like there's so many other like flexibilities of having, like Nav's been mentioning. So I think it's, there's more to it than just the tax rates and the grind down of the small business rates. It sucks, but you know, it is what it is, but there's other reasons for why you should do certain things.
We've gotten very deep into
very early.
We're about 10 minutes into
I know.
I want to kind of pull back a little bit. So common mistakes you see real estate investors make when they're starting out from a tax perspective.
I kind of mentioned one already. And it's when you own a variety of properties and you start moving in and out of them. Mm-hmm. So principal residence, when you move out of it and you start renting it, in the CRA's eyes, technically, that's a change in use of property. And when you have a change in use of property, you're deemed to have disposed of that property at fair market value.
So, and because we get this question a lot from clients and from people that listen to the show. So how does that work? So say for example, I'm living in my property. I want to leave a trail of revenue properties behind me as I move through the market. I now rent out my one bed that I had lived in. Mm-hmm. What happens with the capital gain exemption? How does this play out on the ground?
So for you mean for the principal residence?
For your principal, yes.
That's right. You have a few options. I mean, one of them, what you could do, and this is also advantageous sometimes, is to let it trigger that it's a deemed disposition. And now when you go to file your tax return, you're going to file what's called the 2091, which will dispose of that principal residence. There's no tax when you file that form 2091. But now you also get a step up in your overall cost of that property, because it would have been considered to have been disposed at that fair market value at that time. And so that's option one. Option two is you can say, okay, well, I'm going to move out, but I want to maintain that old property as my principal residence. And so there's an election you can file with the CRA to say, for the next 4 years, I'm going to keep that old property at my principal residence. I'm not going to dispose of it. It's not going to get triggered if I file this election with you in the year that I make that change.
You can keep a primary residence designation for 4 years without living in the property?
That's correct.
It allows you this election. So that's why what he's saying is that was one of the common mistakes is, well, before we go back to that 2091, it gets missed all the time because that was something that you never had to file prior to 2016. So when you, prior to 2016, if you sold a principal resident, nobody cared. You know, you'd never have to file anything. And then they brought in these rules that you have to file this. And, you know, a lot of people still think that you don't have to file anything. Oh, it's my principal residence. Why should I have to file anything? I've always lived in it. But if you miss that form, and we see that all the time that it's missed, there is a penalty. I don't remember exactly what the numbers are, but is it $100 per month that you're late or something like that? But there is a penalty.
Yes.
And a lot of people get caught under that. So I just want to make
sure.
It could
be substantial if you're, if you're 5 years late.
Yeah. Well, there's a cap, I think. I don't know exactly what the cap is, but there is a cap on it. But, you know, if it's $2,000-$3,000, like, you know, why? Because it's just easy form to file.
So just so I understand, what would be the circumstance in which you'd maintain your principal residence for 4 years or principal residence when you're not living there? Rent somewhere or leave the country or
you could leave temporarily for work or something different province.
Yeah.
But also sometimes we want to maintain it because perhaps where you're moving, you may be moving for a certain reason, but there may be more value out of the original property to maintain your principal residence there.
So you could hypothetically, 2017, the market's on a run, you move to Lethbridge, you can maintain your principal residence in downtown Vancouver.
Yeah. You got to make sure you file that.
Yeah.
So that the election that he's talking about, again, it gets missed all the time because you actually have to file it in the year you moved.
Right.
Or you had a change in use from your principal residence to, you know, even if it becomes a rental property. Because if you don't file it in that year, again, it's similar to the 2091. There's filing penalties. But what we've actually seen in some scenarios, and I'm sure you have too, is you can actually late file it. It's at the CRA discretion whether they accept it. You pay the penalties and it still outweighs the benefit of actually doing that and claiming the principal residence exemption for the additional 4 years.
Right.
So,
but make sure you check BC spec tax and empty homes tax.
Yes, of course.
Before you have any grand ideas, Matt.
That's
off to moving to Lethbridge.
Vacancy tax. I don't know. There's many other ones.
That's a great example that you gave.
Yeah.
Because in that case, why would you want to give up your real estate in Vancouver,
like
which is going to, betting on the one that's going to grow more and likely.
So you literally in any situation, whether it's Vancouver or Montreal or wherever, Toronto, you can be which market do I think is going to.
Exactly.
For up to 4 years.
Up to 4 years.
Maximum,
That's what I doubt a lot of listeners know about that.
No.
So that's
well, the other nice thing about that, the other nuance is that it actually doesn't even after 4 years, it won't trigger the deemed disposition. It just won't count as your principal residence, but you can continue to own it until you sell it and there won't be another deemed disposition on it.
Right, right. What other mistakes? So that's one. I feel like there's got to be a few others.
There's some new ones now. Like we talk about the new flipping rules. And so there's a federal flipping rule. And now there's also a BC flipping rule. And they apply in different cases and they apply differently as well.
And the legislation is completely different from federal to the BC, which doesn't make any sense, but okay.
Keeping you guys in business though. Well, somebody's got to understand it.
Yeah, but it's just confusing, right? Yeah. Because you got to read the federal stuff, then you understand the federal stuff and you got to explain that to a client. And then you look at the BC one and then you understand it. And then you're like, oh, these kind of contradict each other. Like what's happening here? Like why couldn't they just get on the same page?
Yeah. Right. Are you able to kind of spell out those,
the
differences and how people are falling into the trap?
Yeah, we went to a tax conference and they explained it really well. And they said, anytime you have a client that has a piece of real estate, you need to look 2 years behind to see what's happened with that real estate. And you need to also factor in what's going to happen in the next 2 years. Because either way, you need to make sure that they're not going to fall into these rules. What I mean by that is the BC flipping tax, it's a two-year rule. And so they're looking for primarily properties that have been sold for a profit anytime within 2 years. And it's not been held for that long. The federal one is 1 year. And so anytime that you change the property within 1 year, they're going to basically say that that's a flipped property. And it will only apply really when there's a gain.
Right. And it doesn't...
That's a really good point because I think that was something that we were talking about when these rules originally came out. So what they said is, oh, we're going to tax you if you make money.
Yeah.
But if you have a loss, we don't know what's going to happen. Like, I don't know if they can claim that loss against like other income or like there hasn't been many commentary on that, right?
The reason why he's saying that is because for the federal one, at least, as you know, when you sell a property, it's referred to as a capital gain. It's capital property to you. And so capital gains are only taxed at 50%. And so that is what typically happens when you sell any capital property. But when it's a flip property, they actually change the characteristic of it and they call it inventory. And inventory is taxed at 100%. And what
normal income.
Exactly. Yeah. And what I mean by 100%, it's not that the rate is 100%, but all of the money that you made is taxable.
Gain, yeah.
Whereas when it's a capital gain, only 50% of what you made is taxable.
Right.
So there's been criticism and we've seen over the past few years of the flipping taxes being the government's way of inching in towards the principal residence tax exemption. Mm-hmm. Like, are you seeing signs that the exemption might go away or chatter about that?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that because this budget that came out, there was some crazy rumors that they were going to get rid of the principal residence exemption. I just can't imagine that they would do that. Like that's because so, and like, how would they grandfather it? That would be my question. Like, so if somebody bought a house 30 years ago, then they say, you know, now we're going to get rid of the principal residence exemption. So like, do these people get grandfathered? I'm assuming they will, because the proposals are always like whenever there's actual legislation and then there's royal assent. But then what happens to the future generation? Now we've just lost the ability to claim the principal residence exemption, and we're going to pay tax on this. Like, I just can't imagine.
It's tough, but not to get into politics, but you'd imagine when the boomers are alive, it's almost impossible to put this in because they've all seen a run up for the last 30 years. That would be like suicide. But at the same time, there feels like there's generational anger right now amongst younger people that are having trouble getting into the market. So the idea that like, okay, all the guys who have supposedly made out like bandits in the last 30 years get the exemption, but anybody who's just getting into the market doesn't seems that's tough as well. Anyway.
And I don't know if we answered this clearly, but somebody out there's listening who's owned a property and then rented it out. But at what point is would you be exempt? Would the exemption go until basically whatever the value is when you rent out the property?
Until you, in the year that you move out.
In the year that you move out,
it will be deemed to have been disposed.
Okay. So you should contact either your agent or an appraiser to get that value during that year.
Correct.
Well, you know. I guess we could take one step back and talk about maybe a little bit about what a principal residence is.
Yeah.
And so a principal residence can be anything from a house to a cottage, I think even maybe a motorhome, condo. So those can be your principal residences. And the one key distinction to make it your principal residence, and this is really important, especially if you own multiple properties, is that it has to be ordinarily inhabited in a year.
Yeah, what does that mean?
It's very vague. And I think it's almost purposefully vague.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example. And so let's say you own a house and you own a summer home, a cottage. And every so often, maybe you go for Christmas, maybe you go during the summer and you stay there for a couple weeks at a time. People would think, okay, well, I don't live there. I live in the Lower Mainland. My principal residence is in the Lower Mainland. Technically, if you go by their language, ordinarily inhabited, they're both your principal residences.
Yeah.
And so then it becomes a game of when you are selling either property, when you think about how you want to apply your principal residence exemption, you can pick whichever has the best capital gain per year that you want to shelter, and you can choose which property and which year you want to use that exemption on. And so that it becomes kind of an exercise to save the most tax. You can kind of figure out which is.
Yeah. So you could go back and go, okay, I think this year makes sense to be in the downtown condo. This year it makes sense to be whatever in my Kelowna.
Yeah. It won't be summer home. It won't be retroactive because you don't know until you go and sell it what that gain is going to be.
Yeah.
And then so you don't know how much you're going to shelter. But when you go to file the actual 2091, the principal residence exemption, you can then decide.
You do a calculation. And we've done this where it's like, okay, they bought the cottage in 2000 and now it's 2024, right? But they bought their principal residence that they're currently in the Lower Mainland in like 2010. So then you kind of work out the math because like Nav said, you could claim a principal residence per year on property. So then when you do the calculation, you're like, okay, well, the first 10 years that I only had the cottage that I was living in, I'm definitely going to use that. And then the next 10 years, I had multiple properties. Let me do the math. Which one increased in value more? And how many years do I want to allocate to this property versus that property? And then you do the math and that's how you work it out.
But would you have to be very similar in terms of days of the year spent at each property?
No. So that rule, when you say ordinarily inhabited, it doesn't matter. If you spend 80% of your time or 90% of your time in the Lower Mainland and only 10% of your time at the condo, it does not matter. They're both your principal residences and you can allocate as you please.
Yeah.
What about if you, and I'm thinking this is a lot of retirees right now. So you live 7-8 months of the year here and you are leaving to Palm Springs or Mexico or wherever else and you're renting. Let's say you rent every year elsewhere for 4, 5, 6 months. Is there any worry that your primary residence is not your primary residence when you're doing that?
That gets into residency. And that's a whole complicated issue of its own. Like, you know, are you a Canadian resident at all times?
So if you're still a tax resident of Canada, that would be your primary residence.
And you're not renting out your primary residence. It's just sitting vacant.
You're okay.
So I'm thinking about a lot of people that live in Vancouver and the rest of Canada, maybe not so much, but most people, if they have a single family detached house, they have a suite.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so how does it, or potentially even a laneway home or multiple suites, right? So what happens if somebody rents out part of their primary residence and how does that change things?
I think we should split that up. So you want to talk about the suite and then I'll take the laneway?
Sure.
Yeah.
So the suite is an interesting one because a lot of times the way these Vancouver homes are built, you don't really need to do anything to your house to incorporate that suite. You may need to add a kitchen or something and there's always another entrance for somebody to use. And so that's a really key distinction. When it's your primary residence and you have a suite, they almost think of it as kind of like a incidental situation. It's really just helping you get by to have that suite there so that you can make your payments. And so it doesn't impact your ability to claim the entire property as your principal residence. The other benefit is that oftentimes in the Vancouver real estate, because real estate is expensive and rent doesn't really keep up, it does create a bit of a rental loss for those people as well to be able to write off on their tax return. So it can be quite a lucrative situation, especially your mortgage interest gets written off as well. So oftentimes in that scenario, it's kind of a win-win for those cases. And Mo is going to touch on this, but where it changes and where the CRA pays more attention is where there's structural change to the property to be able
laneway
to
houses.
Incorporate the suite.
Yeah. Just before we get to laneway homes, is there any distinction between legal suite and unauthorized suite, which is, I think, at the city level as opposed to the CRA? But
I guess there are distinctions, but that doesn't fall too much into our purview.
Right.
Yeah.
Asking for a friend. Sorry, and laneways? So structural changes, let's say?
So laneways are actually different. And you know, DMCL, we have basically, there's actually an article on our website. So if you subscribe to it, you could get that article. And it actually talks about laneway houses and CRA is not happy with laneway houses. So if you have a laneway house on your principal resident, what they're saying is that we're not going to allow the principal residence exemption on the portion that's in laneway. So I guess, I haven't seen it right now, but if you were to sell your principal residence that had a laneway, what you would have to do is you would have to prorate. So you would say, I sold for $2 million, let's just say, and you know my principal resident is like 80% of the total property. So the 80% I could claim my principal residence exemption on, then the remaining 20%, that's where the laneway potentially is, that's where you're not going to be able to claim your principal residence exemption and pay, you know, tax.
And that would be on the improvement plus the land.
Correct.
So that could be a pretty substantial hit.
Yeah, that was one of the things we were talking about was, you know, we should talk about when you do sell even a rental property, the allocation between land and building, and then the improvements you've made to your property. So if it's a rental property, even if it's your laneway home, and let's just say, you know, you put a bunch of money into it, when you go to sell, you actually have to allocate between land and building, right? And so, how do we determine that allocation? I mean, I don't know about you, Nav, but is it generally the BC assessment? You know, it kind of has that split on there. If you've got an appraisal report, maybe sometimes they do a split. Yeah.
But where it would get tricky, not to cut you off, but is, you know, in my neighborhood, there's a lot of heritage homes, 1940s bungalows. So you have an old, potentially decrepit house with a brand new laneway at the back, right? Yeah, so then it's like the improvement costs is dramatically different.
On the laneway.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that would factor into your calculation for the capital gain on the laneway.
Right.
Because you can't claim the principal residence exemption on the laneway house. So what you would do is you would have to figure out what your cost base is, right? And what is cost base? So cost base is basically, you know, how much money have you put into the laneway home, right? So that becomes your cost base. And then whatever you're selling it at, then you would have to basically allocate part of that proceeds to your building portion and then calculate your capital gain. Right? I think you had a really good explanation of like what adjusted ACB is. You know, we say that all the time as tax people and people sometimes don't understand it. So I think you had a really good explanation for when we were talking about
it. I don't know if I remember, but
well, yeah, that's, and so just so for people know, so adjusted cost base, right?
Yes.
ACB.
ACB.
So yeah. So what does that, what does that mean?
It's essentially your cost to acquire. So whenever, whatever money you've put into something, that becomes your adjusted cost base. Adjusted cost base is something that is of the individual or the person that put in the capital. And most of the time where it comes to be relevant is when you're factoring what your capital gain is going to be. And so whenever you sell something, the tax that you pay, the capital gain is calculated between what your fair market value is and what your adjusted cost base was.
So what you're selling for, basically, if you're getting $2 million for the property, that's like your proceeds of disposition that we say in tax world, or your fair market value, minus, you know, your ACB adjusted cost base. And one of the things that I just want to add on to the ACB thing is, like, if you're making a lot of improvements, you want to make sure you keep track of them and you keep all your receipts, because that does become your ACB, your adjusted cost base. We actually went through an audit because this individual sold the property. She had a flood, you know, 2-3 years ago. She didn't have insurance. So she put a lot of money into the property, getting it back up so she can live in it again. And so, and she actually did a good job of maintaining all of her receipts and keeping track. And because that becomes part of your ACB. So, you know, you want to make sure that if you have done any improvements, you keep your receipts.
Well, it has, it has to be a betterment, I believe, as well.
Betterment,
right?
Like, yeah.
If you're just bringing it, if you're replacing a washing machine and it functions the exact same.
Yeah, and that's a good point.
Wouldn't say that's capital. It's repair.
And what about, so if you're, you have a rental property and you have it for 20 years and you're just doing general kind of maintenance and improvement, or not improvement, maybe maintenance basically, yeah, that doesn't apply.
Typically, no, unless you can prove that there's some meaningful change. You know, maybe the appliance you had before had a life of 3 years. Now you've got this brand new thing that will last 50 years. Well, potentially that's an improvement.
It's a betterment.
Yeah, yes. Betterment.
So like one example, there's a case law. I don't know exactly what it's called, but there was an example of roof.
Yeah, I was just going to say,
you know, like, so like if you actually just replace an old roof with the same roof, well, that's not a betterment, right? Because all you've done is just, you've taken one roof and just replaced it with another one. But like if you put in this new roof that, like Nav said, now it, instead of lasting it 10 years, it's going to last you like 40 years.
Yeah.
Well, you can make the argument to CRA that that this new roof is a betterment,
and
right?
Maybe, and it's not other technological advancements. It does, you know, it's capable of doing more things,
right? Like a heat pump potentially.
Yeah. Or
yeah.
I don't know much about roofs, but yeah,
metal roof.
Well, there's like synthetic roofs now.
What about people that now? And I'm thinking about the people that have built in the last few years that potentially the improvement is worth more than the actual market value. So thinking about people that have, like, say, houses that they're into it with the land plus the improvement for 3.3, but the market's only there at 2.8.
Yeah.
Well, don't sell it.
But if they are in a position where they have to sell.
Yeah.
So does that, how does like adjusted cost base work in a scenario like that?
Yeah. I mean, well, if it's a rental property, for example, it really comes into question that portion between land and building. And the reason I say that is because you can have a capital gain or a capital loss on land. But for the building portion, you can only have a capital gain on a building. You cannot claim a capital loss on a building.
Yeah. And on rental properties.
On a rental property.
Yeah.
Because the building portion actually makes up part of your UCC, we call it your
undepreciated capital cost.
That's right. Yeah. And so that goes into a different category where you would claim something called, like, the capital cost allowance. You'd claim CCA on it and get a deduction.
Amortization, in other words.
Right.
And so I know that's a little bit tricky to think about, but it's an important distinction, because a lot of times this does happen where people try to claim a loss on a building, but technically it goes into a completely separate pool. And so that's where you would want an accountant to help you figure it out, because that loss actually may not be as favorable as you think.
Right.
Because we're touching on capital cost allowance, I think it's a very important sort of topic, especially if you have a rental property, because like Nav sort of alluded to, is that you really want to talk to an accountant when you, you know, you've got a rental property. And yes, you could take your capital cost allowance on the building portion and it's at 4%. So you could decrease your rental income every single year by 4% of your building value to lower your taxes on the rental property. But the problem becomes is that let's just say you hold this property for 5 years and you've taken capital cost allowance or amortization every single year, and then you decide to sell after the fifth year. Well, what CRA says is like, look, we gave you a benefit for the last 5 years, but now when you're going to sell, we're going to basically tax you on that entire amount, right? Like the way, I mean, generally that's how it works. And so then you end up paying all of that as tax on a one-time basis versus you're getting a little bit of a benefit every single year, but then you're getting hit with a big tax in the year of sale. So, you know, you want to talk to your accountant and tell them like, okay, well, how much rental income am I going to make from this? Is it worth it to take this amortization every single year? Because, and you know what? If they're like, well, you know what? We're holding this for like 50 years. We're going to pass it on to our kids. So yes, we want the tax benefit every single year. So maybe time value of money is good. So just take it every single year if you don't want to sell. But if you're like, no, no, I'm only in this for like 4 or 5 years, then, you know, you got to start looking at the numbers and it's a different conversation to say, well, maybe you don't want to take it because you're going to get hit with tax when you decide to sell.
And it's, again, we're very technical, but pulling back capital gains for people that have rental properties, how does capital gains work? How does it get calculated?
Yeah, so I think we touched on that. When you sell something, whatever your proceeds end up being, assuming you sell at fair market value, your capital gain will be the difference between that and your adjusted cost base. And so, for example, if you bought a property for $500,000 and you down the road sell it for $1 million, your capital gain would be $1 million less $500,000. It would be $500,000. And I think we touched on it before, the inclusion rate for capital gains, meaning how much of that is taxable, is at 50%.
Right.
And so only $250,000 of that amount would even be taxable.
And that's because, you know, the budget did not go through on the increase of the capital gain inclusion rate. I'm sure we all remember that. And there was a big panic around that. And
some people made life changes based on people. Yeah.
So it went up to 75%, and then thank God they took it back and we're still at 50%.
Right.
So.
And just for people at home, so in that scenario, $250,000 straight to the bank. You don't have to worry about any tax on that.
No, it'll be taxed as well. So again, this will be the distinction what Mo mentioned between corporate and personal. So if it's personal, it's at the graduated tax rate. So it depends on your bracket. But at the highest rate, it will go all the way up to 53.5%. If it's
depending on... No, he's talking about the other portion. So the 50% that's non-taxable.
Oh, is that what
you're
saying?
Yeah. That one goes straight to your bank.
Clear $500,000 on the property.
That's right.
$250,000, you can basically set aside that goes in my bank account. I don't have to worry about that.
Yes.
Then it's based on your personal income.
Times of $250,000.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
We're almost an hour in, and I feel like I've got 3 pages left of questions.
I did want to talk about one other thing, the depreciation, because I feel like that's one of those words that in the world of investment properties is thrown around all the time. And I'm pretty sure 75% of the people either hearing it or saying it are like, I'm still unclear on what that actually
is. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So can we just talk about how depreciation and how that works? What exactly does it? All things depreciation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in accounting terms, when you think about depreciation, you're trying to think about what is the useful life of what I have. How long, especially with land, doesn't matter. Land always goes up in value, but the building, how long is this building realistically going to last? And so that's where the depreciation question comes in. I think Mo mentioned that it was at 4%. So that
for buildings.
Yeah. So if you're thinking about it in terms of years, there's a certain amount of years that you think this building will last. And let's decrease the value that we've recorded this property at by that amount every year and take a bit of a deduction to eventually, by the time it has to be replaced, the value of it is technically now zero.
Mm-hmm. And just to mention, the 4% is what CRA has said.
That's right.
We're not, that's not what we're recommending or we're saying the life of the building is. That's just the rates that they've set. 25 years or whatever. Yeah, basically 25 years.
And it would change. And that's building, right? If it was something like a computer, they say more 50% because they think after about 2-3 years, it's obsolete. So building at 4% will have a much longer life.
So in anticipation of the World Cup, A lot of people are thinking about doing short-term rentals coming up. And obviously a lot of people that are maybe have long-term rentals in place, they'll switch to short-term rentals. We've seen that, mm-hmm. particularly with portions of their principal residence. How does tax treatment change if someone switches from a long-term rental to a short-term rental?
Yeah, it's there's actually new rules around this. So we're not very familiar with that piece of it actually, because there's actually new legislation that restricts some deduction that you would generally get on short-term rentals. And I know there's like city restrictions as well on where you can actually have a short-term rental versus where you can't. So yeah,
almost too complicated.
It's a little complicated.
The basic distinction though, when you move from a long-term rental to short-term rental, is a long-term rental is considered to be passive. There's not a lot of involvement that you need to have. A short-term rental in the eyes of the CRA is a business. And so it mm-hmm. does change the classification of what you're operating. And with a business, there comes a lot more onerous responsibilities. You have to factor in things like potentially GST. It gets reported on a different form as well.
Yeah.
There's other requirements that you need to maintain there.
So you and we've seen this play out on the ground, but people not collecting GST on short-term rentals and having a massive bill at the end.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or even incorrectly reporting it, right? It's not a long-term rental anymore. We do see a lot of issues with that.
And I don't know this, but like I would think like spec tax and, you know, vacant empty homes tax, because some of those exceptions are like you've got a long-term tenant in there. And maybe if it's, you know, you don't have speculation tax on a rental property that was a long-term rental, but then when it becomes a short-term rental, then I think there might be some, you know, nuances about, well, now you might have spec tax because, you know, there's shorter terms and not like, because I can't remember exactly which one it is, but maybe it's a speculation where you have to have at least a tenant in there for like 180 days or something like that. Whereas, I mean, I don't know how it would work now that you have short-term rentals. You might not have somebody there for 180 days. It might be, you know, 30 days increments. And so how does that work? Like, as long as you have 30 day increments for up to 6 months, are you okay? Like, right. You know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be a little bit more complications on that.
But if somebody out there is deciding to take this on, because I feel like everybody's hyping up how much money is going to be made in a month or two or what. So you have a long-term tenant that's leaving in May and you're like, okay, this is an opportunity for me in June, July, short-term rental and then re-rent it back in September. That takes out any sort of issues with the spec tax. But really what the consideration is that it's a change of, it goes from passive to
potentially to a business. Yeah.
That's what people should be thinking.
And I wouldn't consider it to be a change in use like we mentioned before,
no.
Where it's that personal to business. You know, it's still, I don't think it changes the characteristics in that regard.
Right. I think I misspoke there with change of use. But
the filing for those 2 months would be different. You would have to include those on a separate form on your tax return.
Right. So so anyone thinking about that would have to really understand
that
active business component and what they, how that changes.
That's
how
right. And also GST. I would definitely think about GST. We're not GST experts, but I just know it's complicated. And so definitely talk to, you know, we've got at DMCO, we do have some people that we work with that, you know, that know their GST and PST and other indirect taxes. So, you know, we're more than welcome to sort of, help.
Perfect.
Help on that piece.
Excellent. I'm thinking about family trusts, and as people are kind of maybe in retirement age thinking about estate planning, when does it make sense to maybe structure it as a family trust?
That's a great question, actually. So a discretionary family trust has about a 21-year life. And so that means after 21 years, you have to either distribute out all the property of the trust to its beneficiaries, or the trust will be deemed to have disposed all of its property at fair market value. The interesting thing about that is, so if you think about an individual, to get back to your question, you want to kind of estimate where they're kind of, you know, in 21 years, would they want to be giving their wealth to their beneficiaries? And so if you have children that are in their mid-20s or early 30s, you would think 21 years from now, they'll be in their 50s. It'll be a responsible time to pass on that wealth. that's kind of where we start to think about, is it a good time to introduce a trust? Problem that you want to avoid potentially is that if you introduce a trust too early, by the time you reach that 21 years of the life of the trust, you may not trust your kids enough to want to give them the underlying property. And then you have to distribute it back out to yourself, and then you're back to square one.
Right. So the trust is ineffective.
It's ineffective in that case. You would want to put it into place where by the time you reach the 21 years or before, you're comfortable to distribute out that wealth to your children. And we talked a little bit earlier about when you pass and you're deemed to have disposed all of your property at fair market value. Well, when you have this trust mechanism, it allows you to kick that can down the road for your children's lifetime. And you can pass on your wealth to them without having it be disposed on your death. And they can continue that growth without having that tax hit.
So can we, just for people, like big picture, how does a trust work?
Sure. Like generally when you have a trust, you have a settlor. And so the settlor can't be somebody that is related to you. Usually it's somebody that's a family friend or somebody unrelated. And the settlor, it really has no substantial involvement other than they contribute the
initial capital
to start the trust.
And they can never be a beneficiary of the family trust. Otherwise, there's other technical problems that we're not going to get into. But so just make sure that you pick somebody that you know for sure will never be a beneficiary of the trust.
Exactly.
And the capital component?
It's usually something that's tangible. It's not really, it's like a gold coin or a silver coin, something that is physically real, but it's not any substantial amount of money.
Right. So what they're also getting, the lawyers don't, they're getting away from like silver coins because they're like hard to find now. But you know, so
silver's at an all-time high this morning as well.
So now we've been suggesting like, you know, $10 bill or a $20 bill. You know, like an actual
bill.
Has
to be
bill.
Physical.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah. Because they like take a picture of it and like put it in as part of the trust document. Yeah. So, and I just want to take a step back on the family trust thing. And it's very important is please talk to your accountant and get a lawyer involved at the time you're thinking about it. Because it's very important to have a good written trust document for flexibility throughout the 21 years. We've seen... And I know Nav has too. Like we've seen so many trust documents that just have not been flexible enough to allow us to do tax planning because they're restricted in the nature of how the clauses have been written in. So, you know, let's make sure you sit down with the lawyer and the accountant to write this agreement in a way that could be flexible 10 years from now. Like, you know, your life's going to change in 21 years. You want to make sure it's your family trust allows you to be flexible from a tax planning perspective.
Right. And to go back to accountant, lawyer involved, we got the gold coin or the silver coin. We've opened the trust. How does it work?
So you have the settlor, that's really their only involvement is to set, we call it settling the trust. When you have a corporation, you incorporate a company. So now that you've settled the trust, you have what's known as your trustees. And your trustees are the people that are usually going to have control. So in our context here, it would be the parents. So it'll be dad, mom. Usually there's a clause for a replacement trustee if anything potentially happens to dad or mom. And then you have your beneficiaries. And so this is where Mo was mentioning maybe you want a bit of flexibility because you don't know potentially down the road you want to add more beneficiaries. Your kids will be your beneficiaries, but then maybe they'll have kids. And then do you want to include your grandkids? Do you want to include your daughter-in-law, your son-in-law, potentially even a company that you control? Do you want one of your companies to be a beneficiary? Do you want your children's companies to be beneficiaries? And so we want to make sure that this trust is flexible enough to add beneficiaries as we please. So those are the three components, your settlor, your trustee who has ultimate control, and then your beneficiaries. And parents love this because in a trust structure, they control. The trust deed will specify, even on their death, what will happen to the trust.
Right.
So they can control beyond the grave. And that's why
that's why everybody loves it so much.
People love the trust.
Yeah.
And to go back to, well, should I incorporate a company and have my properties in there where I can introduce a trust versus holding something personally? A lot of it comes down to control.
Right.
When you have things in a company and you want to pass it on to your children, you have ultimate control. And introducing a trust or even holding voting shares, you have control over your children. And that's ultimately why people love it.
Yeah.
But for people who are listening that are like, okay, I don't even know, like, what is a trust? Like, why are people
It's exactly that.
Control.
Just literally for control. So there's no tax.
It's also flexibility of transferring wealth.
Right. We call it a discretionary trust.
Yeah. It's a discretionary
trust. But there's no kind of tax benefit to a trust.
Well,
in the real estate context,
probably not. Other than transferring wealth. Because, you know, let's just say you've got 10 rental properties inside a corporation and you got a family trust on, you know, at the top of that holding company. You could sort of decide how you distribute those shares, because you could have, say, 3 kids. And this is what Nav was talking about is you have 3 kids and you're like, you know what? I don't want to give my shares to one of these kids. Like, for whatever reason, then you only want to give them to the 2 others. So then you could distribute the shares just to the 2 kids instead of the 3rd kid that you don't want, you know, the real estate to go to.
But couldn't that be done just with a regular will?
It could, but I understand your question. Yeah. I think the issue ends up becoming is if you have a will, you will hold it until you die, and then it will go through your will into your children. All that property that you own will be disposed of on your death, and you will have to pay tax on it.
Right.
And if you don't have the cash, or your children or your executor does not have the cash to pay that tax, they will have to liquidate some of the properties to be able to pay the bill.
Mm-hmm. Probably all of it, to be honest.
Whereas if it's in a corporation, the one thing that we didn't mention is that the corporation, when you introduce the trust is going to subscribe for growth shares of the corporation, meaning that all the accumulation of wealth of the corporation will go to the benefit of the trust. And so when you pass, those shares that the trust owns will not be disposed of on your death. They are held by a family trust that will go through the trust and can be distributed to your children or whoever your beneficiaries are.
At a later time, yeah.
But on a tax-deferred basis.
Correct.
It will not trigger that deemed disposition on death.
Yeah.
And so there is a major benefit.
And so what type of wealth would you... Like, when does a trust make sense? And I guess everybody's different, right? You'd have to look like there's no sort of one piece of advice fits all. But can you give me one piece of advice fits all? When does a trust make sense?
Discretionary family trust, I usually see it in the context of holding shares of corporations, I think is really the key thing.
Yeah.
Really? Okay. Yeah. So even if you have... So,
you know, even if it's like $4 or $5 million worth of... Even like $2-3 million worth of properties inside a corporation. Mm-hmm. And you know it's going to grow because you want to keep those properties in the family, then family trust makes sense, because not only does it make sense from a tax perspective, like Nav touched on, like I said, I think it's from a family, you know, transfer perspective, it makes sense as well, because you can, you know, you have 21 years to decide how many of the kids get this wealth or if none of them get it, right? And 20 years from now, the parents could decide, they were like, you know what, we're actually going to burn through all that cash because we want to go on some crazy vacations or we want to buy this amazing property or do this. Then they could just take the shares after 21 years too, because they're going to be beneficiaries as well, right? So I wouldn't think about it as just a purely tax thing. I think about it like holistically from an overall like family planning purposes, for planning purposes as well. And how do you want to transfer your wealth?
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. DMCL is going to probably bill us if we take much more of your time. So I'm worried about that. So just quickly though, two questions. We talked about this a little bit before we actually pushed record, but non-residents buying Canadian real estate, I know it's coming up a lot at DMCL. How does tax work for non-residents who buy Canadian real estate?
So, I mean, obviously there's a foreign buyer's tax that, you know, you got to be careful of, but just ignoring that, you know, for a non-resident, you know, depending where they're from, you're going to have to file a Canadian tax return and report your, if it is a rental property that you're buying in Canada, then you're going to have to report that income on a Canadian tax return and you're going to have to pay tax on it. And, you know, there has to be some withholdings and, you know, we could get around all of that. But then what they have to do is they also have to report that income on their, whatever they earned in Canada, on their tax return from wherever they're from. So if they're from, say, the US, Canada-US has a treaty that avoids double taxation. So what that means is that if a US resident has a property in Canada and they're paying tax in Canada on their rental property, they can use that tax on their US tax return as a credit. So then they're not paying double tax.
Right.
So, and then when you sell, you know, there are some filing obligation as a non-resident when you sell a Canadian property, because obviously, you know, Canada doesn't want to leave, you know, like if it's a non-resident, they sell the property. They're like, well, we kind of want a piece of the pie too, right? Like, we don't want you to just report all of this gain in the US and pay tax there. Like, you got to do something here too. And we want to know how much money you made. So there's filings that you also have to do in Canada when you sell a property as well.
And withholding tax.
There's withholding tax, but when you file this particular form, you can actually, and it's very important that you file this. So, because if you don't file it, you actually have a withholding of 25% of your total gross proceeds if you don't file this form. But if you file this form, you actually basically are telling CRA, like, look, don't withhold 25% of my gross proceeds. My gain is only X. So only what I will give you 25% of my capital gain.
Your net.
Your net. Yeah, right. Your net. And then what you do is when you file a Canadian tax return to report the sale, you probably had, you know, some other legal fees and realtor fees that you had to pay. You can claim those on your tax return and potentially get back a little bit of that withholding as well. So it's actually very important as a non-resident, when you're selling, to file this. Because if you don't, what the lawyers do is they just withhold 25% of the gross proceeds and they just hold it in their trust account. And I mean, they end up making money on it because, I mean, they just leave it in an interest-bearing trust account and, you know, you don't want them making any money.
Does it matter? So you're a non-resident. Does it matter if you're in Canada or outside of Canada? Like if you're, when you sell?
I don't think that matters.
No.
If you're a non-resident of Canada, it doesn't really matter.
I just heard it's important to have those realtor fees. last but not least, maybe Canadians buying in the U.S. Obviously, lots of people looking at the Sun Belt and parts of the U.S. excited about potential growth. What should they know about buying in the U.S. and maybe some things to avoid?
Yeah, we're not too much on the U.S. side,
but I would just say that DMCL does have a U.S. tax team.
Yes.
And we work with them as well. But maybe you could touch on the Canadian side of things, of if a Canadian person has a rental property in the U.S. making money, what happens from a Canadian perspective?
Yeah. So if you're a resident of Canada, you're taxed on your worldwide income. And so it doesn't really matter from our point of view where you earn that income. You're going to be taxed here no matter what. And similar to what Mo said, if you are to sell it, even though it's in the U.S., you still have to pay tax on that gain in Canada. So that's really the main thing I would say.
Yeah.
Required to report all your rental income, and you may have some exposure to US tax, and that's really where you may want to get involved with a US accountant. The rules are complex in the US because every state is different and they have different rules. Mm-hmm. And then federally, there's different rules. So
it's the same thing though. It goes in reverse because they'll have to probably do a US tax return. And then the tax that you pay in the U.S. can then be used, you know, on your Canadian tax return, so you're not double taxed.
I think I can jump in on one of your questions quickly before we end this. I think one of your questions talked about interest deductibility.
Yes.
I thought that was a really good one.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
So really with interest deductibility, the real key concept is that for interest to be deductible, it has to be in the pursuit of earning income. Okay. And so that's why when you have a principal residence, the interest that you pay for your principal residence is not tax deductible. But there are maneuvers there. How do you get that loan to be tax deductible? And so a lot of times people that have accumulated wealth in other areas, or let's say even if you were to do on a month-to-month basis, you decide every paycheck, I'm going to put $1,000 into a GIC, for example. But instead, if you have a flexible enough mortgage, why don't you put that $1,000 against your mortgage? And then if you have also a line of credit from that same mortgage, you could then withdraw that $1,000 from your mortgage and then invest it in the GIC. So what you've effectively done is you've taken your hard-earned money from your paycheck, you've paid down your non-deductible mortgage and withdrawn funds that are then invested in a GIC, making that portion that you've withdrawn, the interest component on it is now tax deductible.
Because it becomes an income earning purpose.
Exactly.
Because a GIC now is earning something.
So in other words, instead of just investing the $1,000, put it towards your mortgage, have like a home equity line of credit.
That's right.
That you then take the $1,000. And a lot of flexible products, you see that $1,000 immediately, right?
Yeah. So, exactly. You may have like they call them HELOCs, right? The home equity line of credit. every dollar that you paid on your mortgage, you can withdraw that same dollar back in a line of credit. And the rates are not always the same. Usually it's a bit worse off to withdraw through the home equity line of credit.
Like prime plus 0.5%.
Yeah, not a major number. But if you can put that in the market and maybe you're paying 4% on it, but if you can make 20% on it, and also then write off the interest. I mean, it can be pretty good.
It's a win-win. And writing off the interest on, say, prime or prime and 0.5% or whatever, what does that bring your interest rate to on that borrowed money?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would have to do the math on that. Yeah. But no, it does end up being good. And you do see a lot of times, I had a client that they had a $400K on their home equity line of credit, and they also had a GIC of $400,000. And I said to them, why do you have these separate? Use the $400,000 to pay down your line of credit, withdraw again, and then invest it. Because now...
Oh, I see. So they weren't actually doing it effectively.
Yeah. They were paying the interest on the line of on the GIC, but they weren't getting a deduction on the interest from the line of credit.
Right.
And so you can make them deductible and collect the interest.
I think you're giving both of you guys ideas.
This is a great idea. I mean, I think about it for myself too.
Well, that's fantastic. And I mean, tons of takeaways. I feel like I'm going to have to listen back to this maybe a few times to wrap my head around I'm thinking before we let you go, though, we do have this segment called the Five Wire, Five Lighthearted Questions that we end every show with. Can you stick around for that?
Of course.
This podcast is sponsored by Jethro Condos in downtown Langley. Over 100 homes under $425,000 with one-bedroom suites starting at $399,900.
Here's what's incredible, Adam. These condos actually cash flow. When's the last time we could say that about new construction in the Lower Mainland? With these entry-level prices, the numbers actually work for investors.
And you're in the heart of downtown Langley, surrounded by trendy cafes, artisan bakeries, and parks. The area is experiencing incredible growth and new development.
Yeah, the location is absolutely key. Jethro is steps from the future Langley SkyTrain station. Get in before that transit connection transforms the area. Because once that SkyTrain arrives, you're looking at direct connections across the Lower Mainland.
Jethro is a Whitetail Homes project. Whitetail Homes has over 25 years of experience with quality construction and finishes that exceed expectations. We're talking vibrant interiors, expansive windows, and thoughtful design.
For realtors listening, they are offering amazing cooperative incentives. This is a rare opportunity where the fundamentals make sense. Affordable entry, cash flow potential, and positioned for major transit infrastructure, an all-around win.
Register at jethrocondos.ca. That's JETHRO condos.ca.
Jethro Condos, distinctly Langley, uniquely yours.
One book that you've read recently that you'd recommend for our listeners?
Well, I've not read a book in forever. So
I was going to say The Income Tax Act.
If you want to fall asleep. Yeah. In the last few years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
Last how many years, sorry?
Last few years.
I started doing yoga. It's helped me.
I think just trying to set a good routine, go to bed on time and wake up at a good time.
And yoga too.
Because I mean, I play a lot of basketball. So just getting that stretch in as you get older, it's a game changer. It's a game changer for me.
Right on. What have you been binge watching lately or a movie recommendation?
Stranger Things.
Really?
Yep.
That's really good. My house right now.
That's good.
New Stranger. Yeah. Or is it a new show or a new season?
New season.
Yeah. Okay.
Number one show on Netflix.
Yeah.
Wow. Where's Landman? Landman's on Paramount, but that's what I've been binge watching.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, that's on Prime, I think.
Prime. Yeah. That's Billy Bob is so good in that.
Yeah.
He's so good in that.
Favorite band or music?
I'm an R&B guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rap, hip hop.
All right.
Yeah.
And last but not least, something that you've purchased for under $1,500 that's had a positive impact on your life.
Under $1,500.
Well, I was going to say yoga mat.
Easy.
That's a tough one. Well, I bought the new iPhone, but that's barely under $1,500.
Is it actually worth it?
Honestly, the battery life for me has been incredible. I don't think every night when I go to charge it, I don't think I've dropped below 45%.
Wow. Yeah, because I feel like before it came out, at least the business news was like,
is there anything here that's actually going to make people battery pull life the camera trigger? Too, but I think the sales are better.
Yeah, but battery how much life. Better can a camera
get? I think the camera is dramatically better. Well, I think so.
They're already so good.
Yeah, I know. They move something around internally to create more space so that the battery inside is significantly larger.
Okay, so that's it.
Excellent. All right. Well, hey, thanks, Mo and Nav. If people want to learn more about what you're up to or DMCL, how can they
get in touch? Yeah, so if you go to dmcl.ca, we have a people section. You can find myself. You can find Mo. You can connect with us directly as well through there. There will be a link that you can contact us. You can also read some of the recent articles and things that we've posted through there.
Excellent. Well, no reason not to have a good tax accountant if you're buying and selling real estate. So
yeah,
that's absolutely. For sure.
Thanks so much for having
taking. No, thanks for having us.
Of course, guys. Appreciate it. Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
So there you have it, folks. Our conversation with Nav Panu and Mo Shahid from DMCL, the tax department, did not disappoint. Great stuff from those guys and many things to think about and consider.
And in the studio, it was good having them in the studio. I think they said that was their first podcast. And then on the way out, we were joking. Sounds like they're going to start a podcast. Not related to accounting, though.
Oh, right. I can't even recall. I do know that they said they'd come back, which is exciting. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Especially when the tax, there's always something new, to talk about there.
Well, that's actually the thing. And I feel sorry. I mean, I don't feel sorry for those guys in this regard, but they got to stay on top of it. And man, what a tricky thing to stay on top of it, especially because like part of that conversation, which was eye-opening, is how the province now with the layers of policy that don't jive with the federal level. So it's like, okay, what do we have to comply to here? And especially when they're contradictory, like it's kind of mind-blowing that there's no communication between the different levels of government.
Yeah, you know what? We're in interesting times and I feel like we have been since we started this show. So the insanity continues. What else do we have for the day, Adam? I'll tell you what we have. VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is where all things real estate related live. We got buyer's resources. We got seller's resources. If you're thinking about real estate in 2026, buying or selling, now is the time to get in touch and we'll get you set up with some of our tools at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. But also, if you're finding this tax advice or anything else, well, it's not tax advice, we should say. None of this is investment advice or tax advice. But if you're finding this show useful, all we ask is either a review, a comment, share with a friend or family member that you think will get value. That's how we're growing and we're looking to grow in 2026. We're back.
Absolutely, Matt. And if anyone wants to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
You can give me a shout. I'll be around all through the holiday season, 778-847-2854 or matt@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
And of course, we got that Kokomo line, info@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Well, enjoy the holiday season, everyone, and we'll see you back next week.
Take care.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.